This is Where We Live. I'm John Benkoski. Shakeups at museums large and small, the man behind Still Revolutionary leaves for a new adventure, and the nation's oldest public arts museum gets a big renovation. Yes, it is Wednesday. It is the Wheelhouse, but it's our arts and culture edition of our weekly news roundtable. We'll be talking about a lot of the big issues that don't seem to get as much play in the political arena as perhaps we'd like. So you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266, about arts news that you care about, that you want to hear more about, 860-275-7266. You can always comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We're joined today by Bill Hosley. He's a historian. He's principal of Terra Firma Northeast, cultural resource consultant. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
And Frank Mitchell is here. He is curator at large of the Amistad Center for Art and Culture at the Wadsworth Museum. Frank Mitchell, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And Mel McCobey is here. She's former co-director of the American Studies Graduate Program at Trinity College with a specialization in museum work. She just retired from that job. And so good to have you here. Thank you so much, Mel.
Thank you, John.
And, of course, Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankoski.
Well, Colin, I want to start with you. And let's set up what we want to talk about, because we were sitting around in our news meeting talking with our executive producer, Katie Talarski, about the idea of having a kind of an arts and culture roundtable edition of The Wheelhouse. Let's maybe talk about some of the things that we wanted to get to. I mean, from my perspective, I'll just say we all see arts and culture as really vital to the state in a lot of ways. But we see some competing trends about how seriously we're taking all this. Some of the things we'll be talking about are budget problems at the Connecticut Historical Society that led to staff cuts. Earlier this year, Real Artways put out an appeal because of cuts to federal funding. The Yale Museum of British Art shutting down for a whole year. New leadership at Hillstead Museum. New leadership coming to the New Britain Museum of American Art in the Wadsworth. As I mentioned, we saw Kip Bergstrom step down from his job at the DECD. He's somebody who's been behind some of the placemaking initiatives. But we've also seen some big new renovations, including at the Wadsworth, the fruits of Yale's brilliant renovation at the Yale Art Gallery. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. What are the things that are really interesting you right now?
Well, first of all, one reason I think that we wanted to do it this way, too, is that a lot of times in arts journalism, to the extent that there is arts journalism left here in Connecticut, what we tend to do is sort of focus on a particular thing, right? So the Harvard Stage does Noel Coward. You know, maybe we do something about that show. Carolyn Kwan does The Rock 3 or something. You know, maybe we do that. Maybe we talk about an exhibition in New Britain. But so much of the truth of the arts and humanities scene in Connecticut is more of an ongoing thing that doesn't really have a capital letter at the beginning of the sentence or a period at the end of it, but really is sort of an ongoing set of questions. And as you suggested, we're in a period of both expansion and contraction. So, you know, at the same time, I was over at the Wadsworth Athenaeum yesterday, and it's really wonderful and amazing what they've done with the space and what's opening up, and there's more to come. At the same time, Ken Dixon from the Connecticut Post reported something that almost nobody knew, which was that there been really, you know, quite a bloodletting at the Connecticut Historical Society, a lot of human capital being let go. One of the things that does intrigue me, I mean, you know, every arts institution is both things, right? I mean, especially museums. They are bricks and mortar, and they're human capital. And you need both. You need the physical presence of the museum, but you also need people. People are really incredibly important. People make the good things happen. People can sometimes make the bad things happen. So to me, that's one question. Another question is sort of engagement and vitality. You know, how well are arts and culture institutions talking to the community, to the people that they need to be engaged with? And I actually want, this is my own little private white whale, but I also feel as though one thing that's collapsed is kind of arts journalism. I mean, compared to what there was 20 years ago in Connecticut, if you wanted to know a lot about stuff, if you wanted to be really up to date on what's going on in arts and humanities in Connecticut, you know, if you were a very, very principled and eager consumer of that kind of stuff, I'm not exactly sure where you go. It's not that The Current doesn't do it. And, you know, I mean, Paul Bass down in New Haven just added Brian Slattery as his arts editor. I mean, there's some good things, but there's not enough. And I do feel as though the arts institutions pay a price for that.
And within the last year, we here at WNPR added Owen McNally and Steve Metcalf to write about jazz and to write about classical music. But again, there is that void. Another thing I'll just throw in there, Colin, and get your reaction before we throw it to the panel, that I've certainly talked about and that we talked about on the program we did fairly recently about Massachusetts and how it's working with the arts, is this sense that when we talk about the arts, culture, history, all these things we'll be talking about today at the state level, at the political level, there is an awful lot of conversation about how the arts can be an economic driver. But there is a little bit of a disconnect between the arts and culture being something that just feeds our soul and that we need, even if it doesn't create one job, and the sense that if we don't create jobs with it, it won't get funded. I guess I'm wondering if what your take on that thread is, because that's a big part of the arts conversation I want to have with the folks who come down here from the Capitol.
Yeah, I feel as though when you think about arts primarily as a tool for economic development, you're missing the point. I mean, that's sort of that's step two. Step one is to have a really vital engagement with the arts and have a very smart, well-equipped government apparatus for supporting the arts, and which I think we have less of now than we did, once again, 20 years ago when the Kennedy Commission on the Arts was a little bit more freestanding. And, I mean, you got to start there. You can't – you're going to wind up with a very colorless and disconnected operation if you start with the notion that this would be good, you know, and it should be a sort of a plus sign on the revenue books. It just doesn't really work that way. I mean, I think that's sort of what you're suggesting with your question, too.
Well, now that we've laid out a little bit of our framework for our arts and culture wheelhouse, it's our weekly news roundtable. We're talking about some specific issues with our panelists here. You can also join us, 860-275-7266. You can always join us in WNPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Mel, I'll ask you to jump on this first. Of the things that Colin and I laid out as some of the major themes we want to talk about, what are some things that are interesting you right now? What are the things that jump to the top of your mind?
I think that the sort of sea change in, especially I know visual arts best, but it is perhaps best indicated by the Whitney Museum's Jeff Koons retrospective that took place mostly over last summer, in which selfies were the most common. First of all, photography was permitted and indeed encouraged. And visitors were largely of a demographic that you don't usually see at museums. They were largely young people. How many iPhones and Android devices were taking selfies, I have no idea. But again, widely encouraged, and most of the buzz about that exhibition and the visitors were driven by things like Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook posts. Now, how different is that?
Well, it's really, really different. And you know, Frank, I was just over at the opening gala for the new renovations at the Wadsworth, and I was talking with some of the folks at the Wadsworth about that, and I think that there is an evolving sense of how we engage with the arts, even from the museum community, that, you know, people are going to take pictures of the art, but the more people take pictures of the art and with themselves with the art and their friends and little videos, that's probably a good thing, not a bad thing.
No, I think it is. I think certainly from our perspective at Amistad, engaging the content and making meaning of it yourself is really, really important. Sort of funny, yesterday I was in our space, and we're right below the platform galleries where Coney Island is, and I think I heard you up there, Colin.
Yeah, probably droning away.
Yeah, I was like, who is that up there? And you can sometimes, it sounds as though you're in our space when you're upstairs talking. And for those who don't know, we will be reopening our space on Saturday, so come out and see Amistad, too.
Well, talk a little bit more about that engagement piece, Frank, and what you think is vital toward getting that moving further. I mean, Colin certainly raised it as a big issue, and Mel's making a really good case that some museums are really grappling with this. I mean, what else can we do to get people excited to get new groups of people into some of these spaces?
I think it's a great chance for disruptive innovation, I'm sort of seeing what happened at CHS in that light. And you'll remember when David Kahn came to Connecticut two directors ago, he did something quite similar. He released everybody at the institution and hired people back, like Kate Steinway, to create this partnership in which they together kind of remade CHS into a really vital, important destination here in Hartford. So being able to think outside the box and having the freedom to do that is so important. And I think we've been a little bit slow as an industry in allowing people to do that and sort of pushing that forward and challenging ourselves to do that. And there haven't been the kind of carrots from our funders and from state partners to help us think about what we would be like as a 21st century arts and humanities infrastructure. And I think that's so necessary.
But Bill, pick up on this engagement piece, because there's a lot we want to talk about, but I'd like your thoughts on this.
I loved Mel's point about museum photography. I do a lot of it, and I'm observant of the rules. And there are places where they, like the Isabella Stewart Gardner, where they practically strip search you and put you in cuffs if you even hold a camera, where actually the Harvard museums, which have recently reopened, they're not only welcoming photography, but in, you know, they've got signage that says, you know, go ahead and take your selfies, and we want you to share your experience. So I think that sort of contagious diffusion of engagement happens when there's a lot of ability to talk about what you're doing. So it's, you know, it's great. And I you know, we've all got the challenges of engagement are tough, whether it's print media or television or movies. Everybody's competing for attention, and it is you got to be more resourceful.
You brought this up, Colin. I like your thoughts on some of this.
I do think, you know, there's sort of a generational thing, because a lot of times when I'm at museums and people are taking pictures, there's this little sort of ripple of not disapproval, but fear. Oh, can you do that? That doesn't seem okay. And but obviously, in a really kind of, there's been a real McLuhan-esque shift here that today's museum goer is today's human being, and today's human being is wired. You know, today's human being is constantly online, constantly in touch, is carrying something with him or her that allows them also to look up things if they have questions. If they're looking at some Howard Kerner picture at the Coney Island exhibit and they have some kind of question that isn't answered there. And you have to think about that. You have to think about the human being who's walking through there now. Very different in some ways. I mean, almost at an evolutionary level, very different from the person walking through 30 years ago.
And if I could make an observation, since you brought up Coney Island again, I was thrilled to see that. That is the most intensively mediated art show I've ever seen, in that they've got five or six video elements, and then there are labels where you can pull up video content with a QR code, and then they've got sort of dial in if you want to hear Andrea Miller Keller and I think it was you, John.
Well, if you want to listen, if you want to call up downstairs in the Contemporary Art renovation, I actually am the host for some of those things, and it's really nice.
Cool.
Well, I'm wondering though, Mel, to talk about that. What do we know about how people want to engage with art? Are we just literally learning about this on a day by day basis? I mean, do we have some thesis about how we can actually get people to interact, or are a lot of these, you know, codes to pull up more information, is that actually overthinking it, when what we sort of sometimes want people to do is really engage in a quiet space with something that's beautiful and meaningful to them?
I think the paradigm has really shifted, John. The paradigm, I think, that Colin reacts to when he sees somebody photographing, and it's like, how dare you photograph in this sacred space? And certainly the notion of a museum as a contemplative, quiet, and indeed almost say, I use the word sacred on purpose, that is changing in part, I think, because we are a wired generation, or some of us are, the digital natives at least. But also, too, because there has been a great deal of market research that has been done in museology, owing to reduced funding from government, from municipalities, et cetera. Even after the crash of 2008, many members of boards were unable to meet financial commitments. And museums had to get creative. So that I think it's a fine line to walk. There's a part of me, certainly, that loves the quiet space and the immersion and the communion with whatever it is I'm enjoying. But it also is thrilling to see lots of younger people who are not traditional museum goers engaging.
Did you have a thought, Frank?
And you can certainly designate spaces for that kind of innovation. The new Smithsonian design space that's been kind of reconfigured is incredible for that. And there are touch tables where you can go and do work there. There's a really nice lab space that allows younger people and families to go in and do really kind of cool, innovative work around design. And there are galleries that are a little quieter, where you really can just reflect on, you know, hundreds of years of design innovation without cameras or digital phones or anything like that.
And a lot of it, though, is, I think, knowing what the rules are, Colin. For us who maybe have the traditional experience in mind, actually knowing what you can and can't do, what you're expected to do in the space.
Yeah, but I think the ultimate message is loosen up. And there still are institutions. You know, Bill mentioned the Gardner. Obviously, they've got a little baggage there.
I was going to say, if you're coming with a huge bag to take something out,
right. Maybe
they're not going to let you in.
But, you know, ultimately, loosen up.
Yeah.
And we've seen institutions that have done this successfully, and then we've seen others that haven't. it. I mean, you know, when Garrison Keillor first came and performed at the Tween House, I mean, he was freaking out all the curators. The Tween House was kind of a different place at that point. Don't touch anything. What are you doing? You know, I mean, he wanted to, like, play billiards on the billiard table. And he said on his show, this place should be a lot more loosened up. If Susie Clemens had lived, you know, there would be, like, crazy people in here doing, you know, cool stuff all the time. Not in the new John Boyer, you know, new space, but like they're in the house messing with stuff. And obviously that bumps up against the curatorial urge, which is a totally legitimate urge. I mean, you can't have people, you know, blowing their noses on the curtains and stuff like that. But you do run into that in some places. Steve Metcalf and I were doing a performance at the Hillstead recently. Oh, this is about a couple of years ago. But at one point, as we were getting ready, I said, can we have some water? And they looked at me like I'd asked for a crack pipe or something, you know. I mean, like, water? You're going to put water in? Like, water? We can't have water in here. Thinking, like, the whole earth is made of water. People are water. Give me some water. And, you know, but there is sort of obviously, you know, there's a mentality that I'm sure the graduates of Mel's program have completely shaken off, but the people who preceded Mel's tutelage still have.
Or people like Mel.
Well, I will just say as we head into this break, I was at the beautiful recently renovated Yale Art Gallery taking in an exhibition of Mexican poster art, and I was walking around, and my wife and I were enjoying, and people were taking selfies, and people were interacting with the art, and one of the guards came up to me and said, sir, excuse me for one second. I said, oh, my goodness, what did I do wrong? She said, there's no chewing gum in the galleries. I didn't know that. I had to go throw out my gum. So there you go. We don't all know the rules. When we come back from our break, we're going to be talking with
silly
our panelists.
Silly putty also. They
yes.
Don't allow silly
putty. Or crack pipes. Mel McCombie is a former co-director of the American Studies Graduate Program at Trinity College. Frank Mitchell is the curator at large of the Amistad Center for Art and Culture at the Wadsworth. And Bill Hosley is the principal of Terra Firma Northeast. Of course, Colin McEnroe is here. We're going to be talking about some of the big shakeups that are happening at museums and other arts institutions around the state and some of the big challenges that we face in funding them. You can join us, 860-275-7266. It's The Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. But today we're taking a news focus on the arts and culture with our guests, Bill Hosley, Frank Mitchell, Mel McCombie, and also, of course, our own Colin McEnroe, who is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. And you have an arts-themed program coming up this afternoon, don't you, Colin?
It is. Probably a show only we would do. We're calling it Gastromusicology, and it ranges from an investigation of whether changes in the diets of some of the great composers actually affected their musical output to a fiendish attempt at Frito-Lay and elsewhere to encode flavors as musical notes so that certain kinds of music would then become, you know, sort of heavily identified with, say, ranch-flavored chips.
When you say that this is a show that maybe only you would do, I think that you might be right.
I think you
might be right about that.
Or at least we would be the only people who would say, we'd need no persuasion. Like, yes, gastromusicology.
The program this afternoon is Gastromusicology on the
yes,
Colin McEnroe Show at 1 o'clock.
We'll
today we're talking about some of the challenges that Connecticut's cultural treasures face. I want to talk a little bit about some of that. We've touched on budget problems at the Connecticut Historical Society, some other arts institutions. Before we get to leadership changes, I'll just go to you, Frank, and really talk through some of that. Talk about what we are seeing right now, what you see around some of these smaller institutions or maybe even large institutions like the Wadsworth Athenaeum and the challenges that they face as far as funding and what, you know, we should be thinking about doing about that.
I'm going to go back to thinking about 21st century arts and humanities, that Connecticut could be a destination for that. I was in Philadelphia on Friday where a bunch of us are working with a number of tech designers there, and they really have made that city into the place that, you know, works for arts and humanities and thinks about the future. They've got great museums, great history resources. They've got exhibition design firms. They've got some university programs that focus on museums. And they've got, you know, young people who are excited about doing this work and who come there because it's all happening there. And we could be that place here in Connecticut.
Why is it all happening there? Well, what are the elements that maybe are missing here or elsewhere?
I think it's sort of like the design innovation elements. We haven't incentivized trying to think towards the future, and we do things the way we used to do things as opposed to thinking about how, as an industry, we should be thinking about doing them for the 21st century. So what do we want in the next 25 to 30 years for Connecticut's humanities and arts organizations, and how do we get there?
But that's interesting, Bill, because inherently a lot of what we're talking about, cultural institutions and historical museums, I mean, those aren't necessarily always the places you'd go to find people who want to do things a new way, because a lot of what they've done is protecting, as we said earlier, the past. So how do we get to that point?
Well, actually, I think nonprofits are sometimes very innovative because they have to be, because when you don't have money, it's harder to, you know, not be thinking creatively. But, you know, what Frank just said, I mean, I think it's a perfect segue into the discussion of placemaking and maybe even the legacy of Kip Bergstrom, because all of these interwoven elements of art, culture, heritage, preservation, urban design, it's all the little connectivities that make a place better and that help communities capitalize on the resources we have. And you just look around Connecticut. I mean, I think one of the things Kip always said, which I loved, is that Connecticut does not have the big nature thing going on in Vermont, New Hampshire, and does not have the big city thing going on in like we do in New York, but we win the combined because we do nature really well and we do culture and heritage really well, and it's this density of content on the ground that is so extraordinary. And I think his work in the Culture and Tourism Agency under this umbrella of placemaking was all about making the kind of connectivities Frank was talking about.
But when we talk about it from the larger standpoint, and the sort of conversation we'd have on a normal Wheelhouse Wednesday is, even given that ability for him to make some inroads around placemaking within this organization, we have seen over the course of years arts, culture, history jammed under the heading of economic and community development, something Colin and I talked about earlier, which is, I think, very important, is that no matter what we may be able to do, we are still doing it on a much smaller scale than states or other places that think about arts, culture on a much grander scale, that actually have cabinet-level positions saying, we want to be the best at something, not just we want to be a part, a little part of a DCD.
No, it's complicated. And look, I mean, in 2003, when Governor Rowland brought all the elements of preservation, arts, culture, heritage together under one roof, the Culture and Tourism Agency, that then for 8 years or 7 years was a freestanding entity. And I loved it. I loved the interconnectivity. I still remember the head of tourism saying to me with a straight face that until they all had to cohabitate in the same building, preservation had never really come up on his radar screen as something relevant to tourism. And I think these you know, when the arts and heritage and tourism connect and talk to each other, we get stronger. Bringing it under DECD, I think the point Colin made about justifying everything purely in jobs created, I certainly agree with Colin.
Mel?
To make a sort of devil's argument, I might suggest that one of the problems that Connecticut has, and I saw this in the reporting on the storms, is that it kind of doesn't exist. New Haven is a cultivated way station that lies between Boston and New York. But other than historical sites, historic houses, there is a way in which Connecticut is not a destination for arts and culture the way that Boston and New York are. It has it all, but it doesn't have enough, perhaps. I mean, I make this as a devil's argument, but I think it's a problem.
Well, let's talk that through. Maybe not enough, but it's about a definition of place of what Connecticut exactly is. Mm-hmm. Because as you say, New Haven is a thing, Hartford is a thing, all these little towns and cities have their own little things. And at the end of the day, is it a cohesive something that we could all rally around?
And that's our responsibility as people who make content and run these institutions to make that argument that we are a cohesive unit and we speak for something and we want to move forward. And we haven't done a good job of that except for in campaign years when we come to the Capitol and say, give us money, we're an industry. And we do that well, and we should get that money, but we should also, once we've gotten the money, think about how we keep the discussion going over those 4 years.
You should get more money, but go ahead, Colin.
Yeah, I think this is an enormous problem, and it's been an enormous problem for Connecticut. It's weird. The arts and culture scene has kind of mirrored, you know, this fundamental divisiveness of Connecticut itself, which is 169 towns crammed in this tiny little space, and the people in Old Lyme think that, you know, they have nothing to do with Old Saybrook, and in fact, Old Saybrook prospers at their expense and vice versa. And, you know, arts institutions have kind of followed that lead a little bit, and there's been way too much of I mean, it's like Connecticut can't see any middle ground between one's own individual satrapy, you know, and Connecticut, you know, whereas, in fact, most of the work has to be done kind of in that middle ground. So I always say, why does Will Shortz bring the American crossword puzzle anywhere but Hartford, which is the home of Noah Webster, but also Mark Twain and the entire Nook Farm thing and Harriet Beecher Stowe and Wallace Stevens and blah, blah, blah. But you have to put all those things together into a coherent thing and say to the Scrabble tournament people or to the crossword, you know, you've got to come here. We've got Noah Webster and all this other stuff, you know, and here's how it integrates. And what we've – and I think there are some very good signs lately. I mean, I think the fact that Real Artways is involved in the Coney Island thing at the Athenaeum is a really good sign. I think the fact that the Mark Twain House and the Harriet Beecher Stowe House don't hate each other, which they did for decades. I mean, they – you know, they live 4 feet apart and they hated each other. You know, that seems to be over. I think that's great. I think the fact that Carolyn Kwan at the Hartford Symphony gets Darko Treznik, you know, and all kinds of other people involved. I mean, Carolyn's idea of programming really involves like a lot of other arts institutions. That kind of stuff is really good. We need more of it.
Yeah. And talk about – and that collaboration piece of it, Bill, that's not an easy – it's not just about towns working together or, you know, the whole state trying to have some sort of overarching plan. It's that individually these organizations seem to be fighting over the same little crumbs and have been fighting not for 10 or 15 years, but literally hundreds of years in a state like Connecticut.
You know, look, we'll know we've crossed the River Jordan when we get from me to we. And that sense of we and collectivity is really – that's not that difficult. And I think one of the things that – there is – you look at New Haven and just look at New Haven, Hartford, Norwich, New London. Those are places of such depth and intensity of content that you just – you almost have to work at it not to succeed at tourism when you've got that much content on the ground. And yet in none of these places has there ever, as far as I know, been a coherent conversation about how we would take the tourism branding piece to the next level. It's nobody's job to think about that. People's jobs involve their institutions, but you've got the convention center. They do whatever it is they do. They don't think of tourism as their purview. And where does that assignment lie? And I think if, you know, you go to – I was in Boston last summer at the height of the tourism season, and in August they're doing 75,000, 80,000 people a day pouring through there. We have amazing content here, and all the things Colin mentioned are brand names.
But Boston is one bigger place that can filter through a lot of those people. I mean, I'd say, Frank, and you know, Bill just mentioned it, maybe we can talk a little bit more about New Haven. What's different maybe in the water in New Haven and the way that New Haven is a place that can attract these sort of people than the rest of the state is in their ways?
It's a really nice synergy having Metro North. The highway dumps people off here. We now have IKEA. I mean, there's a lot that draws New Haven. New Haven has got a great history, and we've got really strong arts organizations. We have had in the past a really strong tourism focus as well, and a number of those folks who used to be part of the statewide tourism entity are still in the city helping us to market the city. And at various times, Yale, the city itself, has thought hard about how do we sell New Haven to people kind of around the region and around the state. And that has really paid off for us.
But is part of it, Mel, having a hub like this? I mean, we don't want to choose amongst all the various places. But right now, because of all the things that Frank just mentioned and other things that we can, New Haven seems to be a place that has already built up this cultural vibrancy that also includes amazing restaurants and shops and a walkable place and beautiful tree-lined streets. It has many of these things already. I mean, do we need to have a hub to center some of the things we're talking about?
I think Frank made fantastic points. I also liked when he talked about making content. But Metro North dumping on, making it easy to arrive there. IKEA is a very carefully, just like Cabela's, is a very carefully targeted destination. But you didn't mention the elephant in the living room, which is, of course, Yale. And Yale is financially doing very well and has put an enormous amount of money and scholarship into reconstructing the campus, the buildings, funding curators, et cetera. So I would say as a brand, Bill mentioned branding, and I think that the branding of New Haven, which is fundamentally Yale plus restaurants, Metro North, IKEA, has been profoundly successful.
Yeah. Well, branding in all this, Colin, I mean, we've spent some time making sport of Still Revolutionary as a state branding effort. But, I mean, how much is branding part of any of this?
Well, instead of branding, I'm going to use a different term, a sort of a deeply intellectual term, fun, all right? So fun is really important, you know, and a lot of times it gets short shrift when particularly when people start thinking institutionally about arts and culture. Fun is, like, really important. So, you know, I mean, Yale and New Haven had a terrible relationship, really, for most of the history of this story. And one of the things that was absolutely true, and I graduated from Yale, God help me, 1976, is nobody stayed. You know, you got the tape on your last box and you threw it in whatever vehicle had, and you got the hell out of New Haven and you didn't come back except for reunions because there was no reason to, because it was not a fun place. There was nothing fun about New Haven, and there was no reason for a 23-year-old or 22-year-old person to continue living there. So one of the things they had to solve, and they did, they solved it very consciously, the partnership of some Yale organizations and some New Haven young professional organizations, the city itself. You know, this has got to be fun. It's going to be fun enough so a person wouldn't be crazy to graduate from Yale and stay here. fun is really important. I think it's how the Mark Twain House went from the most sickeningly unperforming humanities institution in Connecticut to maybe the most overperforming, you know, and basically, I mean, in the 80s and early 90s, and maybe even mostly through the 90s, you know, the Mark Twain House was basically for A, tourists, B, rich people, and C, not much of anybody else. And even in their sort of messaging, their public relations is totally aimed at a New York audience, you know, and they're much more interested in getting the New York Times to write about them than getting the Hartford Current or WNPR interested in them, you know, and they changed. They and I think Jacques Lamar gets a lot of credit for this, but there's other people involved in this too. And they said, you know, this has got to be fun. You know, Mark Twain is fun. You know, he's also angry and, you know, and so that's got to be an emphasis too. And we just have got to get, you know, the lead out of our pants and the starch out of our spine and sort of open this thing up. I think Kate Steinway did a great job. I mean, she's a friend of mine. Maybe I'm prejudiced, but I thought she did a good job of making the Historical Society more fun, you know, than it typically had been. You know, fun's really important. It's underrated.
Well, we were talking about fun. I just want to quickly turn back to New Haven and Yale's role in this. I mean, sometimes we think of Yale as fun, but that's not the first thing we think about when we think about Yale University. The fact is, Bill, that the work that Yale has done around the renovation of the Yale Art Gallery, for instance, has made, I mean, every time I walk in there, I think to myself, this is one of the greatest art museums I've ever been to, and I can just walk in off the street anytime I want. I can go there in between meetings and walk into one of the best art museums in the world, and I can't even believe that that exists. That said, across the street, the British Art Museum is now closed for an entire year. I haven't been in there in a very long time. That seems like a year of, hopefully they're renovating and doing some things, but that's another institution right across the street that could key into this. Maybe you could just talk briefly, Bill, about the Yale role in all this, because so much of the vibrancy of New Haven is really tied to this one very powerful institution.
Well, and you also, just inches up Chapel Street, right where those two museums are, you also have the Yale Art and Architecture Building, which is the only gallery in the state of Connecticut that does exhibits on architecture. And it's just, and then you got Yale Rep. I mean, there is that sense of destination and concentration, and certainly Yale's ability to steward the resources it has brilliantly is great. I think that all the points Frank has made about New Haven kind of turning around are obviously true, and I think it's, you know, it's been great. But I mean, there's no real downside to Yale except that in that town it's almost like a monarchy, in that you don't have 1,000 points of lights. You have Mother Yale, and you have a city, and you have other things. The one constraint, I guess, I would observe about Yale is that it's academic. It's not focused on fun, even though they sometimes achieve that. That's almost never their explicit purpose.
Well, and I guess my point of the question, Mel, is that this whole idea of one big institution stewarding the resources. I mean, this, when you have as many resources as Yale, you can make an inroads in some of the worlds we're talking about in a city like New Haven. But that isn't necessarily the model that we can replicate every place else. I mean, not every place can be New Haven because no place else has Yale.
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, I think the sort of diffused nature of intellectual power, of financial power across the rest of the state works against it. in creating a sense of destination the way that New Haven has done. And I will say, I first started going to New Haven in 1990. And when my husband and I got married in 1992, there was no place to eat except the Lawn Club, Maury's, which does not actually serve food, or Red Sauce Italian. And now you name it, from Danny Meyer to, and name a cuisine, whether it's Malaysian or Ethiopian, they have it. And it is, in fact, fun.
Yeah.
If you can find a parking space.
If you can find – well, there's parking. That's a whole different program that we do here. We're going to head to break, and we're going to read some tweets from people. Michael Lee Murphy says, New Haven is not fundamentally Yale plus restaurants. That's some ignorant branding that actually lets Yale get away with murder. We got a few tweets from the Roops. We need the economy to reward people for arts and humanities. The desire is in the community. The Roops also tweets us, Connecticut needs to embrace being a conduit state like New Jersey. You can build off that, but it takes infrastructure. And from EBK Gallery, I attempt to make the bricks and mortar space and web presence completely dependent upon each other. Parallel spaces. EBK is a little gallery in downtown Hartford. You can keep the tweets coming at Where We Live as we continue here on an arts and culture version of The Wheelhouse on WNPR. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's program, in her new book, Roads Taken, Hasia Diner tells the story of the millions of young Jewish men who peddled their way across the world and fueled the great Jewish migration. We'll hear that story. We'll also sit down and talk with civil rights activist Bernard Lafayette Jr. He worked with Dr. Martin Luther King and is still teaching nonviolence today. He was recently in Hartford, and we got a chance to sit down with him. Those are our conversations tomorrow here on Where We Live. Hope you can join us. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, but we're focusing our news view on the arts and culture today with Bill Hosley. He's a historian and principal of Terra Firma Northeast. Frank Mitchell, who's curator of the Amistad Center for Art and Culture at the Wadsworth Museum. Mel McCombe is former co-director of the American Studies Graduate Program at Trinity College. And, of course, our own Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. We were talking just off the air, Colin, about some of the things we still want to talk about in this arts and culture conversation. And I think the role that some of the people, the leaders of these institutions play is, I think, important. They've played different roles in the past history of Connecticut's arts and culture scene.
Yeah, so for a number of years, I was involved in a series of productions in the Avery Theater of the Wadsworth Athenaeum that were done by, they're like a guerrilla productions, kind of done by this guy named Dan Blow, who ran Japanalia. His son, Tableau, was the music director for Baryshnikov. He'd write music. Ann Cubberly would build incredible Connecticut sculptures and puppets and you know, I don't know, people who wore Dan's clothes would come in from New York and perform and, but it was hard to do, and Lamar would always be dressed up in some really bizarre, volcanic, androgynous way, but it was really hard to do. We'd be tired, and be catching each other's colds, and I'd be sitting on the stairs in the back hallway of the Avery, and I would say, why are we doing this? And Dan Blow would say, because Chick would do it. And Chick Austin was the director of the Athenaeum and made Hartford in the first half of the 20th century as much a destination as it ever was. From the Picasso exhibition to the world premiere of Four Saints in Three Acts, the Virgil Thompson, Gertrude Stein opera. I mean, it was really the case that Buckminster Fuller's teardrop car pulled up outside the Athenaeum and Dorothy Hale and, people got out. And I mean, this was like this place where, Salvador Dali was hanging out in parties in the West End and pulling buttons off women's dresses. And I mean, it was like this insane thing. And one of the things that Chick Austin thought was, I'm in the arts business. I'm not running a museum. I'm in the arts business. So he almost got Balanchine when Balanchine relocated to America to have his base in Hartford. It fell apart at the last minute because of calcified resistance within the art. And the other dance academies thought, oh, that's not fair. They didn't understand. Right. Maybe there would be some synergy there if Balanchine came. But anyway, so, we have to think that way. And I think a lot of arts institutions still don't think that way, that really you're in the arts and culture business, screw categories, and also, just to come back to our earlier point, you've got to integrate. You've got to integrate with what's going around you and be keenly aware. I mean, I love what the Athenaeum's doing right now, and I don't mean to monopolize this, but just quickly wanted to say, I was there yesterday. Fabulous new space. The Coney Island thing is terrific. I'm so glad they're working with Real Artways. Real Artways is so vital because they really do think that way. They don't think in one category at all. But, I was looking at the movie listings. They have a great film program at the Athenaeum. W. Gaudette does a great job. But I was looking for February 22nd, and they're like, I think there's two Sidney Poitier movies, and that's great. date, except that's the day of the Oscars. And right down the hill, so to speak, from the Athenaeum at Spotlight Movie Theaters is this huge Oscar gala that we do every year to raise money for AIDS programs in Connecticut. You know, it's a pretty big deal. And I was thinking, boy, somebody should have figured out how to integrate that. There should be a movie thing at the Athenaeum that spills right out into the Oscar party that's going on Front Street, which interconnects with the Athenaeum. You know, and it's just a little thing, but culture is made up of these little interstitial relationships, and that kind of thing has to happen more and more.
Picking up on this idea of museums being in the arts business, Frank, that Colin just raised, I mean, talk about that. What could we do more of?
I think that's a great template, and certainly we're attempting to do that at the Amistad Center. I mean, we, with this new exhibition, which is all about books and sheet music in our collection, we're working with one of your favorites, Taylor Hobinum, to animate the music collection so that musicians who live in New Haven and in the region are taking several sections, themes in the sheet music, and animating that music. So we'll have some that's Americana, we'll have some that's early jazz, we'll have some that's Duke Ellington, and they're going to compose new work and play that music in a concert in the fall. And they'll be doing some lunchtime talks in the spring.
And that's a great piece of synergy. Bill?
Well, it's, you know, my mentor, when I worked, I was a curator at Wadsworth Athenaeum for many years. And Tracy Atkinson, who was the director that I worked for, he always used to talk about programming to contemporary human concerns. And really, that's like kind of like being a journalist in the sense that if your ears and eyes are open to what's going on in the world around you and you build bridges between your content and what people are already care about, you're going to be more successful. Patrick McCaki, who replaced him, talked about everything we do ought to have one foot in the permanent collection. And I love that idea, the idea that whatever the Athenaeum represents in terms of the constellation of all of its treasures, you extend, you know, into the world with a base from those things. You can't be everything, but they are the things they are. And if they expand on that, it's going to be also exciting.
I'm wondering, Mel, if we can pick up on something that Colin's story about Chick Austin sort of raises in my mind that we've spoken a bit about. And we've gotten a couple of tweets from our friend Stephen Holmes, the art curator. He says it's about content. Lots of museums is one thing. Having museums with great content is different. A conversation that he and I have had a lot is that sometimes in Connecticut, we spend a lot of time making sure everyone knows about the great stuff that we're doing here. But we don't spend maybe as much time doing the Chick Austin thing, which is bringing Salvador Dali and George Balanchine and bringing things here that maybe are from elsewhere, but that would make a Connecticut museum or a Connecticut city a really vital place for people from around the world, from around the country to go. And I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about that balance, because that is something that's a little tricky. It's certainly tricky to find funding for in a world where placemaking and talking about how great we are here in Connecticut is such a big thing.
There's a way in which it relates to the sort of larger culture of celebrity, because in a way, what Chick Austin did was to bring art world celebrities or arts world celebrity. And I think that the arts, not art business, or arts, not art, is quite apropos. But I think that that requires money and the consent of those individuals. And I'd say that's the sticking point, because money is what most institutions do not have.
Money is what most institutions don't have, Colin. I guess I'm just wondering if that's a piece of what we're talking about that we miss. I mean, the sense that there could be something so vital in Connecticut that's not about us going down to the Wadsworth Athenaeum or the Yale Art Gallery or the Harriet Beecher Stowe, that there's people coming up from all over the world who see something that only Connecticut has. It takes something to get there.
Yeah, I think it also, you have to not be afraid of controversy, too. You know, and Connecticut's a very quiet place, and it still is the land of steady habits. I mean, one of the last times the Athenaeum really was, an epicenter thing was during Mapplethorpe, you know, which that was a risk. That was McCaki. He, you know, it was a risk, but it was totally worth doing, right? I don't know if you overlapped with Robin Green. Did you overlap with her? Yeah. So Robin Green was this crazy man who was the head of publicity for the Athenaeum. And he looked like Marty Feldman. He was kind of nuts, you know, and he would like call me up and say, like, at one point they had some Egyptian gold that was stolen, you know, and he called me up and he said, you know, there's a curse on that gold. And I, you know, I asked him some follow-up questions. And it turns out he was operating on the premise that any Egyptian gold that's stolen is probably cursed. But he was trying to get the story on page one. His goal as the publicity director of the Athenaeum was to get the art theft story onto page one. Think about that. That's not typical institutional thinking. But, you know, you don't need money to do that sometimes. I mean, he did throw some really crazy and really good parties, too, in the Athenaeum. But I mean
– which helps to loosen up the press corps quite
well,
a bit, I suppose.
Yeah, loosening up is really important. And just thinking that way. You know, you can have great content, but if you don't have a ringmaster, the number of people who are going to go see that content is going to drop dramatically. And sometimes museums act like they almost have a double mind about this, that they really want people to come and see the great stuff that they do. But it's also kind of a nuisance, all those people showing up, you know. So
do you have a thought about this, Frank?
I lost the question. Although I remember we had some artwork stolen from a public collection in New Haven by a drug gang. And the artists were so excited their work was stolen. They were writing their mother and saying, drug gang stole our artwork in New Haven. sort of finding a way to kind of twist the story and make things fun draws in people who might not come just for money.
Okay, so I'm writing down a checklist of things we need to do. Stage art heist. Okay, that will help Connecticut here. Walt in Agawam. Quickly, Walt, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Thanks so much. I'm a member of the local cultural council up here in Agawam. Although we raise our own funds, we're fortunate to get monies from the state to provide grants. And one of the thrusts of our work is to provide grants to schools and youth organizations to get kids out to enjoy all these various places. If you don't train the audience at a young age that it is fun, as you were talking about being fun, if they don't want to go to these places, then all the funding for the institutions doesn't matter. You need to kind of get people interested in the idea of actually making the decision to go. And, for instance, I heard about the Windsor Historical Society is engaging in a project where they have theatrical people coming in and actually being the people who lived in their houses in 1810. And they interact with audience members, especially children. And so once you make it fun, as you were saying, I think you can train the audience to want to go to these places.
Well, Walt, thank you very much for that. And Bill Hosley, training a younger audience is really, really very important. There's a lot of the sort of art that we're talking about that is clearly very interactive with kids, but a lot of the history that we want to preserve and that we want to make sure these museums are continuing to present years into the future, they're the ones that are sometimes struggling with the funding to do just that, to teach kids how to appreciate this stuff.
Well, I think one of the best things and most inspiring things I ever heard a Connecticut politician say was Senator Don Williams a couple of years ago talking about how the children growing up in this state there's nothing happening in their education is exposing them to the stories that happened right outside their backyards, outside the doors of their houses, that we go by these things and that we should find a way to infuse the learning experience with that sense of place where we are using essentially the content we have is a classroom without walls. And it's I think it's, you know, they've stripped history and civics out of the curriculum. I guess there's some creative art if you talk about STEM versus STEAM. But, you know, we don't do enough, I don't think, to engage youth. For me as a young person, I would say my best days and my worst days on field trips were better than my best days in the classroom.
Well, I think that probably for a lot of people. Mel, go ahead quickly.
Just a quick one. Yeah. I think what is being teased out here is that there's a real distinction and a kind of ideological crisis between the function of the museum. Is the museum drunk history? you know, is it edutainment? Or is it to care for, to curate a space of contemplation? I think the answer lies somewhere in between. But I think that it's reductivist and pandering to simply designate museums as places to have fun. Yes, you have fun, but you, in fact, also go beyond that, and it can be fun intellectually.
Well, and Colin, we're just about out of time, but I'll just say in 30 seconds, a big part of this is leadership. I mean, we're going to have new leadership at the Wadsworth Athenaeum coming soon, at the New Britain Museum of American Art, and other institutions. Who heads up these long-running institutions? That's really important as far as these distinctions we're talking about.
Yeah, and I would second Mel's emotion, too. I mean, you know, fun can't be the only thing, and there has to be substance, too. And yeah, Douglas Hyland is another example of a guy who's really, he really has, his programming has really integrated really really well. A whole bunch of – we got involved in their typewriter exhibition there, which was kind of a real, not something an art museum would necessarily think of doing, but also very steampunk and retro and very cool. I'd just like to quickly plug – I have a book coming out of inspirational quotations from Don Williams. It's available on Kindle form anyway, only.
It's an e-book. Colin McEnroe is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show, 1 o'clock each afternoon. Mel McCombie and Frank Mitchell and Bill Hosley, thank you all so much for joining us in this conversation in The Wheelhouse here on Where We Live.
This is WNPR.